Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 12th of October, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We are delighted to be joined today by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. And we're going to be taking a long, hard look at the rapidly accelerating events around EU military unification. But before we get there, vaccines and a look at the BBC.
News is that 150,000 children in northwest Syria are going to be vaccinated for polio. This vaccine is going to be provided by UNICEF and they're going to be administered by public health officials in Idlib province, 150,000 children. The statement is that years of conflict have forced millions of Syrian children to go without proper vaccinations. This has made them particularly vulnerable to hereditary diseases, apparently. That's quite interesting because, as a number of people have pointed out, it's only a few weeks since UNICEF pushed out this headline: more than 355,000 children under 5 years old vaccinated against polio in hard-to-reach areas of Syria. And this was Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa in particular that we're talking about. But what this article says is that that UNICEF and the World Health Organization and partners have completed the first round of a vaccination campaign in response to the recent outbreak of vaccine-derived polio in Syria. So what they're saying here is that the vaccine that they had already given out caused a release of vaccine of polio virus into Syria. So this was a vaccine-derived outbreak.
A vaccine, I'm going to stress that, Mike, a vaccine derived, a vaccine created outbreak of polio.
Yes, that's right. So this is the second polio outbreak to hit Syria since the start of the conflict in 2011. In this case, the vaccination program, as I say, was around Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa. Prior to the 2011, Syria was completely polio free. What they're saying is that as of the 18th of August 2017, 33 children under the age of five have been paralysed. That's a result of this polio outbreak caused by the vaccine. The detection of the circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus type 2, and this is important, vaccine-derived poliovirus type 2 cases demonstrated that the disease surveillance systems are functional in Syria. Well, that's fantastic. What a great job UNICEF is doing. In fact, if you look at some of the documentation on this, and this is from one of the polio campaigns dealing with oral polio vaccine and dealing with polio globally. And what they're saying is that the oral polio vaccine is an extremely safe and effective tool for immunizing children against polio. Over the past 10 years, more than 10 billion doses of OPV have been administered to over 2.5 billion children worldwide, preventing more than 10 million polio cases, they say. On very rare occasions, they say, OPV can lead to the vaccine-associated paralytic polio or vaccine-derived poliovirus. These are similar but different phenomena. So what they're acknowledging is that in a small number of cases, the polio vaccine will create a vaccine-derived poliovirus. But what it says here is that type 2 poliovirus has been eradicated since 1999. And in recognition of that, oral poliovirus must be phased out to secure a lasting polio-free world. Now, this document was published in 2015, so that's 2 years ago. And they're saying that type 2 poliovirus was eradicated since 1999. And they're saying that we've got to stop using type 2 containing vaccines in order to maintain that eradication status. And yet in Syria, that's exactly what they've been using, type 2 vaccine. So this vaccine-derived poliovirus epidemic or issue in Syria has been introduced because they've been using a vaccine that the sort of body of the church, as it were, is already acknowledging should not be it should not be being used. So that's a pretty incredible situation. I think that's the story more than the fact that UNICEF is acknowledging that, because they have always acknowledged that this was a possibility with the use of vaccines in this type, in this way. The fact that they are using a type of vaccine which they have already, or at least the sort of the body of the church has acknowledged, shouldn't be used anymore, I think that's a pretty staggering situation. So you'll be glad to know that in Afghanistan they're seeking a memorandum of understanding to deal with this issue there as well. So they're really keen to get this stuff spread as widely as possible.
So we're vaccinating when there's a known danger to the vaccine. I wonder who is going to, I hate to use the word compensate, because of course that is a let out. That means nobody is brought to justice. But if I just talk about that issue, who is going to compensate the children who've been damaged by that, or the families in Syria? Is the World Health Organization or the United Nations going to deal with that?
Well, the other thing to notice from this is that the three areas where this UNICEF World Health Organization vaccination program is taking place are Idlib province, Deir ez-Zor, and where else does it say? Well, anyway, they're all ISIS-held or ISIS-infiltrated areas, Al-Qaeda at the very least.
Because they've only got access to those.
They've only got access to those areas.
Yeah. So, of course, dangers of vaccines is a subject that the BBC really doesn't want to talk about. We'll bring you back to this article, which we commented on yesterday. This is, we say, a pernicious article from BBC Reality Check. 100 women, is child vaccination boosted by educating mothers? It's an anonymous article. And we went to town on the fact that, of course, it's supposed to be about fact. But if you look at this paragraph, it introduces the fact that actually this is all to do with estimates and guesses, could be, might be. And there's no deep research by the BBC. They simply refer you to other pro-vaccination websites. But the sting in this one was that the article admitted that they can get vaccinations into poorer third world countries by drifting the need for vaccination in on the back of education of women programs. But in the Western world, there's a problem because we have educated women, but they are turning away from vaccines. Well, of course, the BBC says those effectively, those stupid ladies, they're just being caught out by conspiracy theory. So no dangers to vaccines at all, Mike, apart from where they admit that polio vaccine can cause polio. What a state of affairs. BBC doesn't want to get involved in that at all. But we challenged them on the fact the BBC was putting out anonymous and very poor quality material. I said during the news yesterday we hadn't had a response from the BBC. In fact, it came in while we'd moved into the studio, so I wasn't able to see it. So let's be fair and put it up on screen. Here it is. Brian, nice talking to you. Here, as promised, is the line. And this is from a lady who is Charlotte Morgan, head of international communications, BBC News, with a big banner there, the leaders in global breaking news, Mike, the leaders. So what was the line? Well, let's bring it in on screen for you. We don't generally byline the articles, and by byline they mean name the journalist on the BBC website, but everything that is published meets the editorial standards of the BBC, regardless of which journalist wrote it. So this lady was adamant that if stuff was published by the BBC, we could trust it, and we didn't need to know who the journalists were or what their experience was, because it was the BBC, Mike, and we could trust them. She did admit that senior journalists have CVs on the BBC website. She indicated to me that more junior journalists didn't. My guess, Mike, is that basically BBC Reality Check is cobbled together by interns. I think we're dealing with probably unqualified people who are simply let loose to gather information off the internet. Well, I've got to come back to the lady herself, because here she is. She advertised her Twitter on that email. So meet Charlotte. And she says that she was a Cornish girl exiled in Westminster, in West London, I beg your pardon. So she's Cornish, but she's trapped in West London. BBC News, these are her own views. Well, I picked out this view, which I found particularly offensive. She's pushed on a tweet from a Samuel West, and it says this: "Now I have daughters, I'm fed up with men saying, I have daughters, so this matters to me. Stop treating women by their relation to you. That's the problem. Just don't F sexually assault them. It's a pretty low bar." I find this an extremely offensive tweet, and I find it very interesting that it's pushed out by the woman who's defending the BBC, making a mockery of women in the Western world who are intelligent enough and educated enough to work out that vaccines can be dangerous. But let's move on, because we can have another little look at the BBC. This is another headline from today: tougher penalties proposed for unsophisticated plots. And if we can bring it up on screen, here we are. New tougher penalties being proposed to deal with the less sophisticated but equally deadly terror plots. This is to do with cars or knives, but not bombs and, we'll say, major terror events. And I happen to notice this paragraph down at the bottom: the proposals to be published by the Sentencing Council on Thursday are the first draft of recommendations to be made within a government review of terror laws and will be subject to a six-week consultation. Now, I decided to phone the Sentencing Council to see how this arrangement worked. And I have to say that, unlike the BBC, I had a conversation with a delightful member of their press team, extremely helpful, but he said something interesting. He said that basically this sentence was incorrect.
That couldn't be.
Well, this is what the Sentencing Council told me, Mike. They said that it was incorrect because they had acted independently of the government, in as much as they were not working as a direct part of the government review. They'd been asked to comment, and I'm going to explain how this works. But this man said to me straight off that that BBC report is not correct. So now we've moved away from BBC Reality Check. We're into the BBC in general. And what are we finding? That what they're reporting is not true. So here's the Sentencing Council, the independent non-department body. What does it do? Promotes greater transparency and consistency in sentencing whilst maintaining the independence of the judiciary. Its primary role is to issue guidelines which the courts must follow, etc. The Lord Chief Justice, the Right Honourable Lord Justice Burnet, is president, and he is the man who looks after the judicial members. That's a picture of him there. You can find all this on the website. What I've underlined there for you is that he's an expert in common law, which I find really encouraging. Here is a man who admits common law exists. I think we're going to be seeing more of this man. And it's the Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice that appoints the non-judicial members. Now, this body says we preserve the independence of the judiciary. We could talk about this. But the key point I'm making here is that this organisation under this gentleman says that the BBC report was, quote, inaccurate.
OK, well, another area perhaps where the BBC tends to be inaccurate is with regard to the European Union and any kind of unification of institutions or formulation of institutions within the EU, which may be considered a unifying four. So let's just have a quick look at this then, because the European Union has decided that it's going to step up fraud against any fraud that's perpetrated against its own budget. And so it's creating a European Public Prosecutor's Office. This has been adopted by 20 member states, I believe, have agreed this. It's going to be it's all about enhanced European Union cooperation. It's going to be in charge of investigating, prosecuting and bringing to justice the perpetrators of offences against the European Union's financial interests. And it's going to bring together European and national law enforcement office, efforts to counter EU fraud. Now, this is quite amusing, Brian, because as we know, the EU has not had a set of accounts audited for nearly two decades now. But the key thing here is that fraud against the EU budget is being used as the excuse for creating an EU-wide public prosecutor. And my question then is, how long will it take for this unified public prosecutor's role, remit, to be broadened? Not very long, I suspect.
Not long at all, Mike, particularly as we can see the massive drive to the continued integration of the EU military and the police. Paramilitary state, this is a fascist state building here. And I know David Ellis in a moment is going to be covering some of that. But we need to put the spotlight on Britain's press and media, particularly the BBC, because of course they're deceiving the public by not reporting.
Absolutely. So we'll just remind everybody once again, in 1 week's time, next Thursday, the 19th of October, in Bloomsbury Central Baptist Church, Frum Stop Wars Media on Trial event, headlined by John Pilger. Do get along to it if you possibly can. Now, Defence Matters yesterday, Michael Fallon, also the Ministry for the Armed Forces and the Minister for Defence Procurement, that's Harriet Baldwin, all met the US Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, for the first time. And basically that was the message on screen at the moment, please lend us your aircraft, because they are acknowledging that, of course, everything that UK Column's been saying about the new aircraft carrier is absolutely correct, and we will not have any aircraft for the new aircraft carriers for quite some time. So this meeting was all about, quotes, deepening capability collaboration on F-35s and P-8A maritime patrol aircraft and the UK's national shipbuilding strategy, which, of course, is all about the aircraft carriers included. So that's what this meeting was about. Michael Fallon said, Britain has no closer friend than the United States. And across the globe, our nations stand side by side defending our values. Not sure whose values he's talking about. Our armed forces work together in every area of defence, from planning for future challenges through to working together on cooperation around the world, or on operations around the world today. Sorry, Harriet Baldwin, very keen to thank them for helping the UK field P-8 maritime patrol aircraft, because we don't have any. And of course, that's in support of our joint requirements, and also building on the MPA declaration that she signed earlier with former Deputy Defence Secretary Bob Work, to ensure increased value for money and operational effectiveness for both countries. And what that means, of course, is defence contracts. UK's national shipbuilding strategy right at the heart of this begging meeting, really.
Right, so we're trying to ramp up war with North Korea at the moment. We've got the government saying, oh, well, we're going to send our aircraft carrier. The only trouble is that aircraft carrier isn't worked up yet and it doesn't have any aircraft. So we're now going to borrow some aircraft. The key question, Mike, is, are we borrowing aircraft, or are we going to be borrowing aircraft and the pilots? And are they going to be American pilots? Are we going to look for international pilots? And of course, the next thing I can say with some confidence, because I've been involved in this style of training, is that you have foreign pilots operating from a national ship. You automatically have to be careful, because training policies are different, experience is different. So this is nowhere near as good as having your own trained pilots, your own aircraft operating from that carrier. So I'm going to use the expression gently as a dog lover. This is a dog's breakfast of military operations.
Chemical weapons then. And here we have Peter Wilson, who's the UK permanent representative to the OPCW, which is the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and he was giving a statement yesterday, really complaining bitterly about insidious attempts to undermine the credibility of the OPCW, including attacking the OPCW's technical competence and integrity. Now, of course, the OPCW dug their own grave, particularly with regard to the alleged use of chemical weapons in Syria by President Assad, because, of course, they were relying on terrorists to provide them with the evidence for the use of chemical weapons. And of course, these are the same terrorists that the OPCW itself acknowledges have been using chemical weapons in Iraq. So really his position here is untenable. Just wanted to highlight that. And another thing I wanted to highlight is the fact that Jens Stoltenberg and Federica Mogherini, Federica Mogherini, of course, is the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. She's also Vice President of the European Commission. She and he were meeting at NATO's headquarters, based in Brussels now, of course, their new headquarters that they opened a few months ago. Don't know too much about what was going on in that meeting, other than to say that it was all about NATO-EU cooperation and our institutions, and the fact that those institutions, according to Jens Stoltenberg at least, are even more important in unstable and unpredictable times. They are clearly deeply, deeply in love.
Deeply in love. And, of course, when the passions are high, they'll do anything. Right, we're going to move on to what's happening to Britain's military and what's happening in EU military. David Ellis is going to join us now. He's put together a really excellent package of material. Before we get into David's particular subject area, I just want to remind people of this wonderful email that was sent to me by South West Devon MP Gary Streeter a little while ago, a couple of months ago. Mr. Streeter got extremely upset and I would say quite nasty in his reply when I asked him what he was doing about the reports in mainstream papers, The Times and The Telegraph, talking about Britain's military capability being utterly slaughtered. So he came back, he said, "I have no intention of engaging with you further on this or any other subject. You've brought this upon yourself by your unacceptable conduct over many years." I think my unacceptable conduct was actually asking too many questions and telling the truth. But Gary Streeter, several people said, is talking as though he's a school teacher here.
It is amusing that he felt the need to put the PS that it sent from Gary Streeter personally and not from his PA.
Well, I would like to think that his PA wouldn't get involved in this type of extremely unpleasant personal attack, which is what he did on me when I asked him what he was doing to stand up for Britain's armed forces. My goodness, what a turnaround. Here we are. We've suddenly got Mr. Streeter tweeting here saying he supports his friend Johnny Mercer in standing up for the Royal Marines. And of course, they're going to cut the amphibious ships, which is going to directly hit Plymouth and everything to do with jobs around the Royal Navy in the Plymouth area. So all of a sudden, he's jumped on the bandwagon. I think this might be to do with a little nerves over votes, Mike. But there we are, hypocrisy. Now, what's happening at the moment is that the British military is being cut and cut again. We are close to naval parity between the British and French fleets. And it was David Ellis who was the man who said, well, of course, the cuts are nothing to do with shortage of money. This is in order to help the movement into the EU unified military structure. Now, David, you have produced this set of wonderful slides here. This one took my breath away. The fourth forum of the commanders of, quote, European land forces. Here are those men in the library somewhere. And I'll just show this one. We've got them talking in a very smart room amongst all the flags. Here they are unified on the stairs. What's going on?
Oh, well, this is easy. Let's just do this, the basic, very basic HUT 6 traffic analysis on this. The only thing that's going on at the moment in the EU and the UK in terms of agreement is that the First Lord of Her Majesty's Treasury, the Prime Minister Theresa May, is agreeing to EU military unification process to continue. And the stuff that's going up on David Banks Veterans for Britain site is saying that it's around, you know, into 2025. So for quite some time. So there's no agreement with all what's going on with the other trade deal that we're being told about. So the actual trade deal clearly here is because that's all going ahead at full, you know, at quite some pace. So the actual trade deal is military unification, military union. That is the trade deal. There is nothing else. That's the key thing. The EU must have it, and they will pretty much do anything to get it. So May's tactic of putting our military, our entire military and the industry and the officer training and so on and so forth, all the apprenticeships and the procurement systems and all the rest of it, is going ahead at great gusto. So that's the deal. There isn't another deal. That's the only deal. And all those officers are sitting around this table at the moment. There's a tremendous, that picture there's an absolute cracker, because you'll see some Royal Navy officers in there. Is that, well, they're getting on and they're agreeing it all.
There's some,
At the moment, clearly, they're in their national uniforms. And the question is, of course, is how long is that going to remain so? Because at a certain stage, my forecast is that the EU will appoint over those officers, and those EU-appointed officers will turn up in EU uniform.
David, that is a tremendous point, because, of course, when the UK column first started working on this, I'm going to call it blatant treason. We're going back to 2009, 2010. And what did we see? That the initial meetings between British and French military officers were conducted, amongst other places, at the residence of the British ambassador in Paris. But significantly, those very senior British military naval officers met wearing lounge suits. They didn't wear their uniforms, they wore suits. And this was commented on in the naval publication, Navy News. I picked up on it immediately, because I thought this is similar to the Queen not wearing her crown in Parliament. This is them being encouraged to do this dirty dealing in lounge suits. So they weren't there, if you like, in their full uniform representing the country and representing their military branches. So this was carefully orchestrated subversion. That's what I'm going to call it. Remember that the charity, the Franco-British Council, was right in the middle of that. But I think you're right. We're now seeing them come out the woodwork wearing their military uniforms. But we can expect fairly shortly some form of unified EU military uniform to come into play. Now, you pointed out that there are at least some British senior officers who are speaking out. We've got... what's his name? Alex Burton here, Rear Admiral Alex Burton. He says in a tweet, "I can work around the temporary lack of a flat top, the carrier, but I can't work around delivering theatre entry without the amphibious ships Albion and Bulwark, and my friend Major General McGowan." So I know you'll want to comment on that one, David, but I'll bring in Dannett as well. This is from a little while ago. "I almost resigned under Blair," said Lord Dannett, when he was backing a French general who I think did resign over cuts to French military forces. Now, I'm going to say to Lord Dannett, it's no good saying you almost resigned. If you really had got the intent to do it, you should have resigned. It took the Frenchman to resign. But I would say neither of these two senior officers really understood, perhaps they still don't understand, this very devious drive towards the unified military structure. Are there more senior officers now starting to at least protest?
Yeah, I mean, this instance with Alex Burton is a good one, because it was in response to Luke Pollard down there, one of the Plymouth MPs, I believe. And he was answering a very straightforward question that the MP had put to him. So there's been some discourse over this. I can't confirm it one way or the other, but there's been some anecdotal stuff that Alex has resigned as a result. So that's a great shame if he has. But it dovetails in perfectly with what the modus operandi is. So let's go back to the original chronology here, whether it be Britain or France and their generals and admirals or ours, that what we're dealing with here is EU military unification. We are not dealing with defence cuts. They appear on a national level as defence cuts, but that's not what they are. So it's no good talking about defence cuts. We have to talk about the militaries, the national militaries being unified into an EU force at single point control. So that's what these officers have got to talk about, and that's the target that they have to frame. It's simply no use whatsoever talking about defence cuts, because that is not what they are. On a pan-European level, there are perceived from the EU's perspective that they see no gaps. So we've got to come back. I'd come back in where you first started with the lack of aircraft on our aircraft carriers and the hull parity level now between British and French navies. That when Harrier and Nimrod was chopped in 2010, you know, British systems, you know, work for BAE jobs and so forth. And what do we see now? Jobs being cut at BAE. We're seeing more ships being cut potentially. And what are we doing? We're going abroad and buying a foreign off-the-shelf kit. No good to us as a nation whatsoever, either industrially or militarily. So in terms of what you're saying about what's dangerous, when you were commenting about what's dangerous with importing potentially either French aircraft and French pilots onto our aircraft carriers or American pilots and American planes, I've really got to quote comments that were made to me by Commander Phil Ingham, who run Iraq, run a lot of the operations in Iraq. It's incredibly dangerous. It really is. So, Brian, you're absolutely 100% correct on that. So in terms of the other officers, you know, they are speaking out, but we've just got to move the debate on from cuts, because as one of the first admirals I met when I was looking at the defence scene in terms of cuts, and we didn't know what we knew then now, he said this has got nowhere over 30-odd years. It's just like perceived as banging the drum. So in order to move the debate on, we've got to talk about unified military process, which the EU owns and our government is agreeing to. That is the trade deal, nothing else. You know, I mean, I think this is the other thing, is because people keep going on about NATO. Well, NATO has just brought everybody in as a national military, as a bus, and dropped everyone off in Brussels there with Federica Mogherini. And one of the things that's we've got to state here, really, is that NATO doesn't have a bank. The EU has a bank. And believe you me, they will take control. And they'll take control through there being one pot of money to do this. There will not be two pots of money. There will not be a pot of money for NATO. And there will be, like, you know, another pot. There'll just be one. And the EU will control it. They have to have single point control, because that's the whole concept.
David, this is really serious stuff. I know that there are still some people who watch the UK column who get a little bit squeamish when we talk about the military, because in principle they see the role of the industrial military complex. They see huge global corporations making vast amounts of money from death, basically. We are totally sympathetic with that view, but the reason that we're concentrating here on, we'll say, the politics of what's happening around Britain's military, is that once Britain's military has gone under the control of the European Union, it does not matter what happens in the so-called Brexit, because we no longer have a nation state. This is the real importance of this. And you're saying that Prime Minister Theresa May is doing this under the cover of a trade deal, but what she's actually doing is selling the military. Let's come on to some proof as to what's happening. And my goodness, you've got some astonishing stuff here. European Union external action. I think we've mentioned them before. The military planning and conduct capability. So this is all there in front of us, if we know where to look for it. We've got a concept note, operational planning and conduct capabilities for CSDP missions and operations. So this is all to do with the EU command and control structure. And I'll read the last paragraph on this. It says the overall political aim, according to the Council's conclusions, is to improve the EU's capacity to react in a faster, more effective and, quote, more seamless manner as part of an EU comprehensive approach. Moreover, strong emphasis is put on enhancing civilian-military synergies and on building on existing EEAS structures. Now, that civilian-military synergy not only involves procurement. I think, Mike, they're also hinting here at this integration with civilian police forces and the military.
I'll go back to the 2015 European Defence Agency conference, and they were doing a lot more than hinting about it. They were talking about it openly.
Right. So there we are. Now, the small print always counts. And if you read the article I've just shown you, we're into the small print here. And, well, it's moving ahead. It says to avoid unnecessary duplications with NATO. So there's no messing around. They don't want any confusion as to whether it's EU forces or NATO. They don't want duplication. And they're talking about a, quote, permanent operational planning and conduct capability at the strategic level for non-executive military missions, working jointly and ensuring an integrated civilian-military CSDP engagement with the planning and conduct capabilities. This is the command and control structure visible now, David, and these people are already running an EU military. It just hasn't quite broken surface.
Correct. That's absolutely correct. This is the how to take command manual. So we've got a lot of anecdotal stuff from former senior officers on this, in terms of one particular officer said to me, oh, well, he was all right with it, just as long as it was funded properly. So there was no caution as regards the creeping of national sovereignty. So in terms of the nuts and bolts here, I've got to give all credit to Major General Julian Thompson, Royal Marines, who spoke at the Bruges Group, who gave an absolutely first-rate speech, hit the nail on the head, exactly what needed to be talked about, from the whole round robin, from engineering, jobs, procurement, shipyards, all the way through to the coalface in the Royal Marines or the Navy or Air Force or whatever. So what he said was brilliant, and that needs precipitating out. But you're quite right. This is the take command manual. And everybody's got to understand that the reason this is important, it's the key thing the EU require in order to get their treasury. So this component, this major component of unifying Europe, i.e. military union, will get them their treasury in order to manage it. Once they've got their treasury, they will then tax, set a single point budget and allow them to precipitate with all of the euros issued. So there are huge sums of money involved, and there are huge political levers. Now, that being so, of course, all of our engineering in this country used to anchor off the defence industry. So car industry, so on and so forth, all of that stuff anchored off it. And as we've cut one end, we've cut the other. And Lord Tebbit said to me the other day, well, you know, once we've Brexited, you know, we need to get out there and establish our customer base. I said, well, that's all very well, but what are we going to sell them? Because all the engineering has been absolutely annihilated. So, this is a very key thing. So for May to be going down this avenue, it flies in the face of exactly what Brexit is, because how can you have this facade of, you know, we're leaving, but our military and all our engineering, all the decent stuff that's left in BAE, Babcock, Rolls-Royce, whatever, is going to go in. It's going to go into this. So that's Brexit, is it? No, it isn't. That's right. That's something completely different.
David, yes, Julian Thompson obviously picked up on that, but he said we were stumbling into a trap. Now, it is a trap. The UK column hasn't stumbled into that trap, because we were warning about it years ago. We were absolutely correct on everything we said. We're still waiting for organisations like Veterans for Britain to really back up what Julian Thompson is saying. Where are the so-called organisations supporting Britain's military? Why aren't they speaking out? Why aren't they giving people the detail we're giving them?
I can't answer that. I know, Brian, you're doing your bit there at the UKC. You know, we're doing our bit. I don't know. I can't answer for them. They need to answer for themselves. But I will say this, in just rounding this particular section off before we go to the next slide. What's going to happen here is, once they get their military union and they get their treasury and they tax, we would have put our entire military into this for free, and then we're going to get a bill. This is the ultimate trade deal.
OK, well, let's bring in a little bit of EU propaganda, because we might laugh at it with one hand, but it's been printed and somebody is seeing the picture. So we've got an article here, towards an EU military command, question mark. So there's no messing around there. EU Defence Cooperation Council establishes a military planning and conduct capability. So this stuff is hidden, the trap is hidden in plain sight. I find it difficult to understand why some of these senior people can't see it. I often joke they're too busy playing golf. Well, that's one possibility. But many of them have got quite senior jobs in the city. Are we really to believe these people can't see it, or are they too scared, which is another question I've asked?
Well, I mean, I can say without any evasion or equivocation here with this, General Dannett, when we met, he went into the House of Lords that afternoon at a capability debate in the Moses Room in the Lords, and stated that what was coming before the government was effectively a Trojan horse. And this is completely correct, except it's our own government wheeling the Trojan horse in. This is the absolute insanity of all this. So General Dannett got it. He understood completely what the mechanics of this was, and that the British people would not support military union. But the big problem is, of course, is that the 20 million Brexiteers just don't know about it. I think the analogy here I would like to use, without patronising anybody, is that if you're at the scene of an accident or, you know, something hideous has gone on, which are the people that you take notice of? Do you take notice of the ones thrashing around and making the most din, like Theresa May and David Davis? Or do you take notice of the ones quiet in the corner that are laying flat and face down, that are not making any noise whatsoever? So there's the political topography sort of analogy there. It's the ones that are quiet we've got to watch here.
Right, David, let me just single in on this comment you've made about the trade deal, because, of course, this morning we've got headlines like this in the Telegraph. Michael Barnier, who's the EU's negotiator with supposedly to do with Brexit, hits out a disturbing UK stance as Brexit talks hit deadlock. And, of course, this is supposed to be all about Britain trying to arrange a trade deal with the EU before we get the final bill and all this kind of stuff. And what you seem to be saying is that when we hear talk of trade deals in the media, we're actually talking military unification. Have I got that right?
No, sort of. What's happening is, of course, you've got two tracks, okay? You've got two tracks. Very quiet track going on, that on the left of military unification. It's proceeding brilliantly, and that's all being agreed. And you've got this track on the right, where all the bluster and fuss and chatter and traffic of, oh, you know, we want to get this trade deal and the access to the single market and da-da-da-da-da-da, and it's not going anywhere, and we might have to walk away, and there might be no deal. All that's a load of bunkum. That's just absolute radar jamming tosh. And they've already let the cat out of the bag. The chatter, the traffic analysis on this, the GCHQ analysis is, you know, from my opinion, you know, all that is just a distraction. It's a sideshow. The real deal, the only deal, is military unification. The other stuff of Duncan Smith. Let the cat out of the bag yesterday, didn't he, by saying, you know, well, the Treasury will have to make money available when there's no deal. I think he's already told us what's going to happen, because there was no deal. There was never going to be a deal.
Okay.
Really, military union.
Yep, right. Okay. Well, in the meantime, there seems to be other stuff going on behind the scenes, not being reported in the mainstream media, because here we have a joint letter to World Trade Organization membership, which is showing progress and coordination to prepare for future trading arrangements post-Brexit, in inverted commas. What they're saying is that the UK and the EU have worked cooperatively as they seek to maintain existing levels of market access for countries. Since the EU referendum a year ago, the Department for International Trade has been forging ahead to establish the UK's future independent trade policy as we leave the EU, in inverted commas. This includes separating out the UK's trading commitments to other WTO members from the EU's overall commitments, as the UK's current commitments to other World Trade Organization members, such as the tariffs it sets, are applied through the European Union. And so the UK and the European Commission have written to the World Trade Organization membership jointly. And all this is going on in the background, unreported, while, as you say, we've got all this noise going on in the mainstream media. And so, you know, if we go back again, if I mentioned David Cameron's Best of Both Worlds document, the issue of global trade and TTIP and TPP and so on was at the heart of that, along with security and defence. We just continue to see this quiet negotiation going on under the surface while all the furore of distraction is going on in the mainstream press.
That's absolutely right. It's absolutely totally correct. I mean, really, what we're saying is there's not been any change from the black and white there with Cameron as to what's effectively what's happening now. The only change is, of course, is that they've agreed considerable amounts of military unification. That's the only change.
Yep. David, thank you very much for that excellent analysis. We will say the United Kingdom, is in very, very dangerous times because, of course, we're seeing this massive propaganda campaign spreading out across the country so that news outlets, including the BBC, are denying the general public information or are putting out information which is provably false. These key issues of EU military unification simply not being talked about, and the reason is they are desperate to drive this through under the radar. And at that point, I say to our audience, what will you be doing today, this afternoon, tomorrow, next week, in order to bring this to light? Because it's up to each and every individual to do something. Get on the phones, be tweeting, be sending emails, be knocking on the doors, asking the question and showing this pernicious government that the wider public are aware of what they're doing. It's not up to UK Column to be sitting here on a day-by-day basis pushing this information out. We push the information out for people to act. And I'll say, I called the BBC yesterday. I called the sentencing committee this morning. That conversation was well worth having with both parties. How many of our viewers and listeners have also picked up the phone to make their views known? Polite, reasonable. But if we let these people get away with it, what ultimately happens is our fault. So a bit of a blast there, but we'll end on that. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, and we should be joined by David Scott, giving us a report on matters north of the border. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.